surprised to know that packaging today still includes lead, cadmium, formaldehyde, PFAS chemicals. We want to ban the worst. Third, we have a very strong definition of recycling, so it does not allow for the polluting technology called chemical recycling or advanced recycling to count as real recycling. And there are other important details, but we all grew up reciting reduce, reuse, recycle in a kind of sing-songy way. We never get to reduce and reuse. We're kind of still dabbling in recycling, and most of the money in the waste arena goes toward burying waste at landfills or burning waste at garbage incinerators. So the bottom two rungs of the hierarchy, bury and burn, get most of the money and most of the attention, and we want to change that.
The book is called The Problem with Plastic, and there's a website, beyondplastics.org, where people can learn about Judith's appearances, talking more about the problem with plastic. Judith Ank, so much, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Boogaloo Joe Jones, Billie Holiday and Louis Armstrong, and Let's Go Green. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
Listeners, sponsored stations count on you, not Arbitron. So when you push their buttons, you get radio that turns you on.
Hi there, this is Ann Feeney, and you are listening to listener-supported community radio, KVOO FM in Portland.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Carolyn Sipinka. Carolyn is the Assistant Director of Exhibitions at Portland Japanese Garden. She's talking about Designing Nature, Elements of Harmony, a show on now at the Garden through February 23rd. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Carolyn.
Thanks so much for having me, Joseph. This is a really special exhibition, so I'm excited to share it with you.
So this is a show at the Garden about gardens, Japanese gardens, and this gives an awful lot of background information about the history of Japanese gardens, and it also focuses on this garden. Then there are also artworks that relate to the concepts of a garden. When you walk into the pavilion gallery, there's a lot of didactics, stuff on the walls, pictures, and lots of text. But there are these four little models of the garden in vitrines that give you a view of Portland Japanese Garden, but they're little architectural models. So tell us about these. Who made these?
Yes. So exactly, walking into the Pavilion Gallery, which is in the garden itself, we have the garden in miniature. So you're immediately met with these very exquisite scale models of four different sites within Portland Japanese Garden itself. The Flat Garden, which is immediately outside of the Pavilion Gallery.
So the Flat Garden is the one with the lots of gravel.
Yes.
That's always raked.
The gravel.
And the trees currently have these ropes on them for snow, but that's another thing entirely. What are the other three?
Yes, the Flat Garden, the Sand and Stone Garden, the Strolling Pond Garden, which includes the Heavenly Falls and the Zigzag Bridge, and then the Tea Garden and part of the Strolling Pond Garden, which also incorporates the Moon Bridge. So these four familiar sites, but at a smaller scale. Japanese gardens are an art form in themselves, and there's so much history, design, strategy, thought, and artistry behind them that we wanted to give people a deeper layer to understand them. With the thinking that, like with any art form, you can, of course, experience it at the surface level and have an incredible experience just walking through the garden, but to understand it can unlock a deeper sense of appreciation for this incredible art form.
Mm-hmm. So the artist in this case was Amy Eng. She normally builds architectural models for things that are going to be built, but you said this is kind of her first time working backwards. She came to the garden with a camera and a measuring stick?
A measuring stick. It was incredible to watch Amy work. We knew that we wanted to give people visiting the exhibition a deeper understanding of different parts of the garden, and what better way to do that was through scale models. So at several different times this past summer in 2025, Amy came to the garden, worked with our amazing garden team, and measured proportions of different things in the garden, took photos, took sketches, and really captured the beauty of the garden space so she could bring it to life in these small dioramas. So if you look very closely, you can see a tiny, tiny little bamboo fence that's actually been tied with twine. Mm-hmm. That perfectly mirrors the bamboo fence that you can see outside just in front of the weeping cherry tree. Or a small lantern that perfectly mirrors the proportions of the lantern that you can see just outside the gallery doors.
Mm-hmm. So this is like traditional modeling where the trees look like little broccolis, and she's kind of sprayed the cherry tree with a pink, some kind of foam to make it look like blossom. This isn't like 3D printing or anything. This is very handmade and a kind of obsessive kind of miniaturization, but perfectly to scale.
Perfectly to scale. And some aspects are 3D printed, such as the lanterns. So I think that it's really lovely to be able to see these incredible parts of the garden at the scale. And some, just like you said, were handcrafted using both found materials. Amy often mentioned searching to find just the right stone that would perfectly match the stones that are at the border of the Flat Garden, or the stones that stand in the Sand and Stone Garden, or materials that she purchased for modeling supplies. So a combination of mm-hmm. materials.
When you walk over to, say, the little model of the Strolling Pond Garden, we see the stepped kind of hillside and gray stone steps, the koi pond with little fishes in it, and the bridge across the water. Is there anything in these shapes that we can see from above that are, you know, specific to Japanese garden design?
Definitely. So all of these forms relate to different points in history and design approaches of Japanese gardens. The zigzag bridge, for instance, is also called Yatsuhashi, which were prominent within Strolling Pond Gardens. So this was an art form and style of bridge that appeared in Japanese garden history, which you can see on the timeline, which is on one of the gallery walls. So I love that people were able to kind of understand the significance mm-hmm. of different things in our own garden that are tied to moments in history in Japanese garden design.
Mm-hmm. So the idea of the zigzag bridge is you just get to spend more time over the water. It's just like enjoying looking down at the water more.
Definitely. And Strolling Pond Gardens, just as the name implies, they're meant to be experienced. You're meant to stroll through them, experience the irises brushing your ankles, see the koi up close, versus other styles of gardens where you're meant to view them, such as some aristocratic gardens, from a specific vantage point, in which the entire garden was arranged for you to view from one single perspective. Whereas Strolling Pond Gardens, you're meant to experience them from multiple perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And Portland Japanese Garden, of course, is unique because we have several different styles of garden all in our space. So you can see all these different approaches, both in the garden itself and explored through these models. Something that I think is really special is getting to experience a familiar landscape from totally fresh perspectives. So you're able to walk around the tea garden from a 360-degree view or see it from above, which I think will give you more appreciation for the spaces that are so familiar.
The third of these models, the tea garden and strolling pond garden, there's a lot more foliage. You know, the trees are bigger. You can see the path through the trees. You can see the little green stream. And what's that bridge there?
Yes, that is the Moon Bridge. All the models are incredible, but this model, I think especially, it's easy for the viewer to shrink yourself down to that scale and picture, you know, yourself walking over the Moon Bridge, walking down the path to the zigzag bridge and experiencing this landscape in miniature. This exhibition was created by both of our curators, Aki Nakanishi, as well as Hugo Tori, our garden curator. So a combination and a collaboration between art and gardens, working together to bring the garden's beauty to life. Something that we really tried to explore through the show, and that will appear in multiple parts, is the Japanese garden's appreciation of scale and proportion. Something that many people are familiar with is bonsai, or trees in miniature. So there's often a different appreciation that's given to artwork, to things in nature that are brought to a different scale. You can see them through a new light. So we've kind of taken that similar approach to these models. Another thing that really helped guide our decision to include the models in the show was to help people study gardens from a new perspective and relating to something that garden curator Hugo Tori shared, which is that at sometimes Japanese gardens and gardens are conceived and thought of from a bird's eye view. So what better way to really try to capture that than to give viewers that experience of looking at the garden from above?
How would someone like 800 years ago get a bird's eye view of anything? Did they have hot air balloons with them?
I think often careful study and a real understanding of the landscape. Part of the heart of the show is the Japanese concept of nature and understanding of nature, which is Shizen, where I think in the West and in North America, we think of nature as being separate from humanity. But Shizen really captures humanity as being part of nature. We're all one, people are part of the landscape. So I think that understanding of the interconnectedness between humanity and culture and nature really helped shape people's understandings of garden design in Japanese gardens mm-hmm. in the past.
So there is a moon viewing bridge, and I guess you would maybe find one of them in most well-made Japanese gardens. What's the idea of having a bridge to view the moon?
Moon viewing is an important part of Japanese culture. We have a moon viewing festival every year. And so having a special site to view this beautiful celestial event, I think is a really beautiful way that evokes that interconnectedness of culture and nature, where human hands and hearts are shaping the natural world and creating beauty and experience, but then also enhancing the beauty of nature. So you can appreciate the moon from anywhere, of course, but to be able to create a special place to view the moon, I think is something that feels really intrinsic to garden design.
And is it just that with a bridge over water, you have a clearing, so there's more better, you know, it's not blocked, and then you get the reflection of the moon?
Yes, I would say so. It's a space that was developed in relationship to the elements around it, including the moon, including the river coursing underneath the bridge, including the pool where you can see the reflection of the landscape in the moon.
Mm-hmm. Could you say a little more about miniaturization? So if someone has an acre and they want to build a Japanese garden, do they look for plants that will be smaller than, like, trees that aren't going to be like 200 feet tall? You know, is the idea to cram as much different stuff into one place as possible?
I would say it's less cramming and more thinking about relationships. So thinking about, and this ties to Japanese garden design history, which started in revering nature as sites of spiritual ritual, the idea that kami, or God, is present in every aspect of nature, so revering nature to emulating nature, in which perhaps you love the aspect of a waterfall, but you can't put a waterfall in your backyard. But perhaps you can bring a bonsai, you can bring landscape and miniature into your backyard for further appreciation, which is part of what shapes that motion and that movement of Japanese garden design, is bringing landscapes that are larger in nature into a miniature scale that you can then appreciate in your own backyard or mm-hmm. garden.
And I mean, there's usually an attempt to have different heights, you know, that like a mountain, you have some slightly bigger rocks or some way of looking down and water flowing down, things like that.
And those elements that you just noted are the three key elements of Japanese garden design: water, stone, and plant. So you can see those throughout the exhibition, and of course outside in the garden itself. All those elements, I think, are present in every single part of Portland Japanese Garden.
Mm-hmm. So, Carolyn, the didactics is this kind of table on the wall of a timeline mm-hmm. with drawings and photos of different types of Japanese garden over the centuries from 300 BCE up to 1912. You said gardens began as places to revere nature, and you have this photo of two black rocks joined by knotted ropes. What is that?
So in early origins of Japanese garden design, nature was a space of reverence and spirituality. So those ropes were tied to identify sacred sites, and different key elements such as stones or suhama were created as borders to water bodies. And suhama and that kind of border around a reflective pool of water were used to indicate the divide between the living world and the spiritual world. So these landscape elements, which are very physical and beautiful in themselves, have these deeper significances, which started in these very early origins of Japanese garden design history. And yeah, exactly, this timeline it's on one of the biggest walls of the gallery space. It has a lot of great visuals, and you'll see these visuals are tied through and evoke different sites in Japan in Japanese garden design, but they look very familiar to sites that you can see in our own garden. Pools of water, stone compositions, zigzag bridges. So the idea is to share just a taste and an introduction to Japanese garden design history through scenes and images that you can then relate to gardens that you experience in the present day to help you better understand them and appreciate the artisans and communities that build this incredible art form.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Carolyn Sapinka. She is the Assistant Director of Exhibitions at Portland Japanese Garden. And Carolyn is talking about Designing Nature, Elements of Harmony, which is on now through February 23rd. Carolyn, one thing jumps out to me is this photo on the timeline wall of these three rocks on moss surrounded by kind of gravel that's been raked in concentric circles, and it says stone compositions Ishigumi, and large stones were selected and thoughtfully arranged together. Now this is one of these things that makes it so different from Western gardens to have a big or two or three big rocks sort of put together, no explanation, like what are they for? I think in Western gardens you try and prettify everything mm-hmm. and formalize everything, shape it. Mm-hmm. But this is like wild nature dropped in. Then on the other side of the gallery you have these artworks, which include stones. So is there some relation between the ones that you find in the garden and the little ones that people would put on their desk?
Definitely. So those are two different art forms, but they relate in significance. And this is kind of a different approach to gardening than you would see in Western gardens. These beautiful stones, which you can see in our sand and stone garden, which is the raked gravel area with the arrangement of stones at the center and with different gravel patterns around them.
That's the area that you go down the hill towards
exactly.
On the east side.
Exactly. So you view those from a distance, from a specific vantage point. So they've been arranged so you can appreciate them from that perspective. And that stone arrangement relates both to Buddhism, Karisansui, which is dry stone garden, which is a particular style of Japanese gardens. And the arrangement of these stones in an asymmetrical pattern relates to a Japanese garden design principle in theory, which is asymmetry and imperfection. So if you're familiar with the concept of wabi-sabi, age and imperfection. So thinking against symmetry, against this kind of human shaping perfection, but allowing that imperfection to help you better appreciate the empty space or the ma, which is the Japanese concept of emptiness, around the rocks. So it's specifically designed to inspire those feelings both of wabi-sabi, of ma, and to make you appreciate the landscape around it by the emptiness around the stones. So it's very intentionally placed.
On the other side of the gallery, where you have artworks, you have paintings, sculptures representing plants, stone, and water. You have these suiseki, which are rocks that people find that look like mountains.
So I'm so thrilled that we're able to have these three examples of suiseki, which are landscape viewing stones from the collection of Jeffrey Robson. These are three stones exactly that artists find in nature. They're not carved, they're not crafted, but the beauty is in perspective. So an artist would see a stone in the wild and think, that looks like the mountain from my hometown. or that looks like an island that I visited, through the shape of the stone, and then they would be brought back and displayed in such a way that enhances those qualities.
Mm-hmm.
So these are another example of miniaturization and scale in Japanese garden design. Two of the stones in our exhibition are displayed in a basin called a suiban and a doban that's filled with fine sand. So seeing this very dark stone positioned on this basin with sand really enhances the quality of, oh, that looks like an island rising mm-hmm. out of the sea. Or the tall stone in the center is a mountain stone, which evokes, of course, a mountain. And that's displayed in a carved daiza, which is a wooden base, that instead of carving the stone to fit a perfectly symmetrical round base, the base is carved to fit the stone, mm-hmm. which I think is a really beautiful yeah. part of this.
It's a sort of dark brown, cloud-shaped, polished piece of wood, the base of a tall gray stone, which has a lot of, it's smooth where people have touched it. So that's the concept of stone, or if that's a concept. Then you have plant is represented by two amazing bamboo sculptures. So they took very thin strips of bamboo, maybe 2 millimeters wide, and formed them into bands of, you know, maybe 50 pieces across, so like 6 inches across, and then wove them or bent them when wet into this kind of infinite loop. This is a sort of brown, shiny bamboo, but it forms this loop about 2 feet tall, and it's this one of those shapes that you can't ever find the end of. And this piece is by Honda Shuryu.
Yes.
Time Undulation.
These are two incredible works by contemporary bamboo artists from the collection on loan by Peter Schinbach. And we're so thrilled, as Joseph shared, to have these on display. This section of the gallery, we just left kind of the education or the history section of the gallery. Now we're in the art section, where we featured artwork that evoke the three key elements of Japanese garden design: stone through the suiseki, and plants through these incredible bamboo baskets. It's a centuries-old art form that's used in various aspects of Japanese culture, from tea ceremonies to ikebana arrangements to being sculptures themselves. So the two examples that you shared, that we are sharing here, are very experimental.
Yeah,
very sculptural.
These are not baskets. These are kind of wild shapes created by the imagination of the artist. Water is represented by this beautiful painting, which you've put a bench in front of and a shiny black pedestal, so it reflects. So this is a mineral pigment painting, so white on a mulberry paper, which is black. So you've got these white drips and spray marks cascading down onto a black surface, and the painting must be about 15 feet wide. It's huge.
This incredible painting, Waterfall, is by iconic Japanese artist Hiroshi Senju. Hiroshi Senju is famous for his waterfall paintings. He has exhibited at the Venice Biennale, at the Victoria and Albert Museum, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and we're so thrilled to be able to have one of his pieces here. They're so meditative. And just as you said, we have this bench positioned in front of the painting so you can really sit and take time to appreciate it. I think this is another lovely example of scale, perspective, where time seems to have paused. You're looking at a waterfall caught mid-motion, the water dripping down the canvas, frozen in midair. And I think it's so lovely just to be able to sit here and be immersed in this landscape and to be able to bring this part of the landscape, almost like the heavenly falls in the garden, mm-hmm. Into the pavilion gallery. Hiroshi Senju is famous for his Nihonga style of painting, which is a Japanese painting technique, which uses mineral pigments, so crushed stones and shells typically, combined with animal hide glue and water to create painting material.
You know how when you stare at a waterfall, like at Silver Falls, and it's sort of waving as it goes down, you're trying to follow a drop progress, but you never can. This painting captures that feeling, whereas a photo of a waterfall always looks kind of blurry, and, you know, the exposure's too long, but it looks cool in its own way. Yeah, this is a kind of contemporary painting based on centuries-old ideas about what a waterfall means in Japan.
Definitely. Water has always had a sacred and important significance in Japanese culture. It's literally a life force. So I think it was very intentional and poetic to have the main topic of this painting be water caught in motion.
So, Carolyn, we're now over in the Tanabe Gallery, the small gallery next to the gift shop, and we're looking at gardens as living classrooms. So this is a wall display of mainly really big color photos of four different Japanese gardens in Japan. So these are like, you know, what you would see if you did like a big tour of Japan and went to kind of its four amazing gardens. Who picked them, and what are all the other books and things around here?
So part of our hope for the show was to really explore the incredible history and knowledge of Japanese gardens. So this gallery focuses on those four prominent Japanese gardens in Japan: Kairakuin, Kenrokuin, Kōrakuin, and Ritsurin, and shares these beautiful photos that we hope will transport visitors to the scenes of these gardens and hopefully see some familiar elements to our own garden, like similar moon bridges or strolling pond gardens.
So Ritsurin is in Kagawa Prefecture?
Yes, and these photos were selected in collaboration, of course, with our curator and Japan Institute director, Aki Nakanishi, as well as the gardens themselves. So we were in conversation with these gardens in Japan, and we're so grateful to also get these messages from the governments of the prefectures who shared these kind words about the exhibition.
So in the Ritsurin one, you see a really big moon bridge. It's probably 20 feet high at its apex, and it's in a pond where you can take a boat. And just amazing kind of round bushes on a little round island. It's like a big scale Portland, really, Japanese garden. Here's another one that's all lit up at night, the Okayama garden.
This is Kōrakuin in Okayama Prefecture.
So again, it's another lake with a hillside going up and stone stairs going up to... is that a temple at the top?
I'm not certain.
Looks like a temple.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, these photos, they capture both daytime and nighttime scenes. So gardens appreciated across times of the day and also seasons. So one of the photos from Kenrokuin captures a familiar sight to Portland Japanese Garden in the winter, Yukizuri, which are these beautiful rope installations, which are tied to the pine trees and other types of trees with the purpose of preventing them from damage due to snow. So just as in Portland Japanese Garden, every season brings a different kind of magic and beauty in Japanese garden design. We currently have the Yukizuri rope structures on display. And there's different types of flowers and plants, too, that are also on display. Like winter camellias will start to bloom soon. And currently there's pops of reds from the Andina, or heavenly bamboo berries, which you can see throughout the garden.
So it is part of the concept of a Japanese garden that it can be enjoyed in all four seasons. We're in rainy Portland winter. What can people see here? Because I know they come for the cherry blossom, they come for the fall leaves. What can you see here in January, February, March?
Definitely. Seasonality is a very important part of Japanese gardens. So you can see those winter blooms of camellia, white and pink, which I think are so gorgeous, as well as that heavenly bamboo, Nandina, these bright red berries that almost look like holly berries at smaller bushes throughout the garden. In addition to the Yukizuri rope installations, I think that it's so atmospheric in the winter to come here. Often you'll arrive and the garden and the hills will be encased in fog. It feels almost like you're transported back in time to this little oasis above Portland.
It is an amazing location because you get that cloud off the West Hills. And also with less foliage, you can see more of the structure of the plants and the landscape.
Exactly.
What they've done with rocks and things here.
And with the rocks and the structure of the landscape, we've tried to also evoke that through some of the books that are open to certain pages in the Tanabe Gallery. So we're so fortunate to have our volume library, which is one of the largest collections of books on Japanese gardens outside of Japan, which is an incredible resource for members and guests of Japanese gardens.
I know the volumes have their name on everything around here. Were they particularly into Japanese art?
Extremely. They've been incredible supporters of Portland Japanese Garden and all of the programs here.
And there is one other section. There's a local Portland photographer who for 50 years has been shooting this garden.
Yes. Just around the corner of the Tanabe Gallery, you'll see a special exhibition of black and white photographs by Stu Levy. Stu is a local photographer who's been a literal neighbor of the garden. He's lived down the street from us for over 50 years, and he's captured the garden in different seasons and across the years starting in the 1980s. So these photos capture moments in time, of familiar scenes in the garden, but through his beautiful and very poetic photographic lens. So we're so thrilled to be able to show this exhibition about the art and beauty of Japanese gardens. And for people interested in learning even more, I'm so excited that we'll have a special free webinar about the history of Japanese gardens, and especially how Japanese gardens traveled to and really captured the imagination of Western audiences throughout history. It'll be next Thursday, January 15th, at 5:30 p.m. Visit our website to register for the webinar for free. But it'll be an amazing conversation with Portland Japanese garden curator Hugo Tori and Professor Kendall Brown, who's written extensively about Japanese gardens and Japanese art.
Would there be visuals?
Yes, we'll have amazing visuals on display of Japanese gardens throughout history and exhibitions and expositions of gardens, as well as a virtual walkthrough of our own exhibition here.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Carolyn Supinka. She's the Assistant Director of Exhibitions at Portland Japanese Garden. Carolyn was talking about Designing Nature, Elements of Harmony, a show on Now at the Garden through February 23rd. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus once again, Carolyn.
Thank you so much for having me, Joseph.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my wall. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Sintonizando KBOO Portland en el 90.7 FM y a través de la internet en kboo.fm.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7.